Our guest, Misha Glenny, is an award-winning journalist. He worked for a number of years as correspondent for the BBC. He was the Central Europe correspondent for BBC World Service. In 1993, he won a Sony Award for his coverage of Yugoslavia. He's contributed to most major U.S. and European papers and current affairs magazines and is regularly consulted by U.S. and European governments on Balkan issues. He makes his home in London. And over the past couple of years, he has been involved in a major reporting project that takes a look at organized crime around the world. Few people probably would have predicted that the greatest success story to come out of the collapse of the Soviet Union would in fact be the globalization of organized crime. And our guest, Misha Glenny, says that today, this shadow economy accounts for something between 15 and 20% of global gross domestic product. It takes advantage of new technologies like the internet. It feeds off of the poverty of the developing world. And, he says, it's also fueled by the material affluence of the West. And what he has been doing now over the past couple of years is traveling around the world, looking at different places where organized crime has grown. In the countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union and in the Soviet sphere, but he also has been in Asia. He's been in Latin America. One of the things he said was that he was surprised that in Canada, organized crime is as much of a problem as it is. He spent time talking with people who were criminals, and he spent time talking with people in law enforcement. And it's a really remarkable piece of reporting that he has done. And the book is now out, and it is available in bookstores here in the United States. The title of his book is McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld, and the publisher here is Knopf. Well, Misha Glenny, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
That's all right.
I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Something I'm sure that we know is that organized crime is not new, and that organized crime has existed in many countries around the world. But having said that, you make the argument that perhaps over the last maybe 10, 15 years, there has been a significant growth. Can you put some numbers on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a huge growth basically since the coincidence of the collapse of communism and the advent of globalization, such that now what I refer to as the global shadow economy, which includes organized crime but also includes corruption, corporate fraud, and tax evasion, accounts for about 15% of global GDP. That means 15% of the world's economic activity is not being monitored by any type of state authority. So that is a huge wedge of our economy going unmonitored, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And it has, as you say, and we can talk about this, certainly has been made possible by economic globalization and by the spread of international communications, particularly in the internet. But perhaps more than any other single, and those things would have been true regardless, but more than any other single factor, the thing that has contributed to the growth of organized crime is, as you say, it was the collapse of the Soviet Union.
That's right. what happened is none of us really, very few people anticipated that communism would collapse, and certainly no work had gone into the idea of what might come after communism. And as communism collapsed, so did the state administrations throughout Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union. At the same time, what you saw is that with the sort of surge of democratic sentiment and wanting to get rid of the communist past, a lot of countries sacked thousands and thousands of security force members. So, for example, in Bulgaria, in the 2 years after 1989, 14,000 security service personnel were sacked. Now, this at a time when the economy was contracting, when state budgets were very poor, and these people, their main skills were in things like surveillance, killing people, building up networks. And with the absence of state authority and with the fact that they no longer had incomes, they turned instead to organized crime. And some countries, not all, but some countries in Eastern Europe emerged out of this as veritable factories of organized crime.
Mm. You've spent a lot of time writing about the conflict in the former Yugoslavia, and certainly people are used to the idea that this was at its base through and through an ethnic conflict. And I think that though other writers, you and other writers, have tried to say, well, you know, there's really a lot of other things going on here. It was not so much about long ethnic hatreds as it was the opportunity of people to get something. It certainly was a land grab of mammoth proportions. But again, you make the argument that this war, in fact, was a cover for an incredible amount of pure and simple criminal activity.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, what I think was most striking about the former Yugoslavia was how you saw cooperation between the very nationalist paramilitary leaders who were exhorting their fellow citizens to kill people of other ethnicities, and yet they were collaborating in business deals with their counterparts amongst the other ethnic groups. So you would see Croats and Serbs paramilitary leaders cooperating together on business deals throughout the wars. Serbs and Albanians, Bosniaks and Croats, Macedonians and Albanians, they were all involved in this together, and they all built up very substantial, essentially criminalized empires. What they learned at a very early stage during the war, that Yugoslavia was a very effective transit zone for illicit goods and services coming from all over the world, straining to get to their market in the European Union. Because as Yugoslavia was going on, Western Europe was becoming much richer with accruing the first benefits of globalization. And a lot of West Europeans liked to spend their money on, you know, taking drugs, sleeping with prostitutes if they were men, and smoking untaxed cigarettes and employing illegal migrant labor. And this material was coming through Yugoslavia using the fog of war to assist this huge smuggling operation. And it necessitated the cooperation of Serbs, Croats, Albanians, Bosniaks, and Macedonians, and that's what's happened.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that of course, a lot of people would want to make the argument that war is not good for anyone, but in this particular case, it seems, and I'm sure you can point to the same thing happen in other places where there's conflict, you can say that war is good for criminals and for crime.
War is very good for crime and criminals. War is generally good for a small elite who are able to use the conflict to get their hands on some type of money-making activity. So, for example, we saw at roughly the same time, and continuing indeed, in West Africa and Central Africa, wars in which you saw criminal gangs sell weaponry into places like the Democratic Republic of Congo or Angola, whilst the warlords were selling mineral resources, very valuable mineral resources, out to those criminal networks, who would then insinuate them into the illicit economy in the Western world. These were dreadful conflicts in Africa in which millions of people died, all because markets wanted to get their hands on diamonds and other key mineral resources.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you point out that's certainly very important here is that in so many of these places that the lines between the legal and the illegal economies, between people in government and in banking and criminals, that that's a very fuzzy mid-ground between all of these, the legitimate and the illegitimate parts of the economy.
A very fine, fuzzy line indeed it is. People who are in the shadow economy and criminal organizations, they are very adept at spotting where you have weak states. If you have weak states and weak state institutions, these areas are very easy to subvert, and you can indeed get hold of the state administration to advance your particular industry. I mean, we have seen emerge over the past 5 to 10 years, for example, Guinea-Bissau now regularly referred to by Western law enforcement agencies as the world's first narco state, as importers and exporters of cocaine through Guinea-Bissau have basically seized control of the whole place. Because of the immense financial resources available to them, it is extremely easy to subvert some states.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, and we have a caller I'll bring into the conversation. We're talking with Misha Glenny. He is a former Central Europe correspondent for the BBC World Service and wrote a lot about the conflict in the former Yugoslavia. He is the author of a newly published book that's the result of a lot of travel and a lot of reporting different places around the world, looking at the spread and the growth and the significance of organized crime. The title of his book is McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld. It's out now, and it's published by Knopf. He's spending some time in the United States talking about the book. Today he's in Washington, D.C., and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. And toll-free, no matter where you are, if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Caller here where we are in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. This is a real Guardian's Knot, and just ripped out of the headlines, there was something about a Serbian deal cut directly with Baghdad authorities. There was a denial that the U.S. military knew what was going on. I guess the weapons were deficient and not as bad as an earlier deal that actually was brokered through Alexandria, Virginia, and it wasn't through Serbia. But it reminds me that there was also this, when Petraeus was in Mosul, he cut a deal, and that these AKs were the ones that were all unregistered that came through through Serbia too. So the U.S. military is quite willing to use some of these cutouts when it serves their purpose. We have that example of that major Russian arms broker who was, you know, on a State Department corrupt list, and the Pentagon was still dealing with him on rather massive regards. It seems to me that part of this is larceny. Part of this is covering up things that you want to do covertly. The biggest one that I can think of right now is the armaments that are going into PJAC, bleeding the Iranians across the Iraqi border. I don't know exactly how those deals get brokered. There's allegations that defense contractors in Iraq were used by the Pentagon to do that. And it's all boggling, it seems to me. I don't know whether you can sort some of that out for us at this moment or not. Would you like to try?
Well, it's a very good question, and it highlights one of the things that I think I established during the research over 4 years for McMafia, and that is, if you're involved in the shadow economy, if you're an organized criminal syndicate, or if you're an actor of some sort or another, and you can get yourself the support of the security services, particularly of a powerful state, then basically you've hit the jackpot. Now, that is what happened to Viktor Boot, who's the Russian arms dealer you're referring to, who was recently arrested in Thailand at the request of the United States. It's the Department of Justice which is particularly concerned to see Boot under lock and key. But as you also rightly point out, the Department of Defense used Boot's services in Iraq, and it's another reason why he's been so successful. I think if we're going to combat these things seriously, we have to start drawing lines somewhere. We have a situation at the moment, for example, in the United Kingdom, where under the previous government of Tony Blair, just before the present Prime Minister Gordon Brown came in, the Serious Fraud Office dropped a huge investigation at Tony Blair's insistence on the grounds of national interest into the corruption of the BAE Systems deal with Saudi Arabia at the urging of Saudi Arabia. Now, we are not in a position to go around the world lecturing people on corruption and good governance if we drop big corruption cases in the national interest, because the Nigerians, the Chinese, and whoever else we're talking to about anti-corruption strategies will just say, how dare you say that to us when you drop corruption cases in the national interest? So we've got to be very, very strict about our behavior if we expect anyone else to follow the same lines.
What do you make of this idea that these shadowy mafia types are quite useful for the kind of covert things? I mean, there's a long history of this in the CIA docket.
Not just the CIA. Most major criminal operatives come across the security services in one form or another. I mean, you know, there was a very interesting article. I urge everybody, if they haven't already done so, to watch The Sopranos very carefully and watch The Wire, because although they're both set in the United States, they're extremely subtle at picking up changes that are going on in the world. And you may remember in The Sopranos, at some point, Tony Soprano starts talking to people from the feds who are involved in counterterrorism and giving them information about a couple of Arabs who he's had commercial dealings with. And this is one thing that has happened in the past 7 or 8 years, is you've seen resources move away from the general area, the shadow economy and organized criminal activity across borders in particular, over to the terror agenda. And this, it seems to me, is a completely false economy, because terror is something that exists within the much broader swamp of shadow economic activity. And if you start doing deals with people involved in that, you can get yourselves into some very, very tricky situations very quickly.
Well, we have. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to another caller. This is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yes. I'm rather interested in the area north of Afghanistan and Iran and south of Russia. That area seems to have become a conduit for narcotics coming out of Afghanistan. And it appears to me that the governments are closely involved in this. Is that true?
Well, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it was always likely that the Russian state, which has a very powerful tradition, would at some point awake from its hibernation and start to reassert itself. And I think that's what happened with Vladimir Putin. However, the other states of the former Soviet Union, which include the areas that you're talking about, to wit, Tajikistan, Kyrgyz, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Georgia, and the other Caucasus countries, mm-hmm. did not have that strong state tradition. and as soon as communism collapsed, there were large amounts of heroin coming out of Afghanistan into Tajikistan and beyond. Indeed, at this point, the Russian military had also pretty much collapsed. It wasn't receiving any state funding, and much of the heroin that was moving out of Afghanistan through Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and so on was actually being transported by Russian military planes, who were sort of subcontracted out to do this work. That situation has changed to a degree, but Central Asia is still a major conduit for opium and heroin coming out of Afghanistan. So is Pakistan, and it also moves after there through Mumbai into East Africa, down into South Africa, then up into Europe and the United States. But, you know, we basically have a huge problem in Afghanistan, because in 2003 the Taliban were a defeated force, and the West had an opportunity for the first time in about 150 years to put in some serious development programs into Afghanistan and to remove it as a problem both politically and in terms of narcotics off the map. But instead, we made invading Iraq our major priority, and we neglected the development of Afghanistan. Now, in 2003, the Taliban was a defeated force. The game was over. But because we didn't put in the development strategies that were absolutely essential, they have managed to restructure themselves, rearm, and refinance themselves, and they refinance themselves almost exclusively through the sale of opium and poppy. And this means that what this effectively means is that the war on drugs, which basically confers huge value on the commodities of an illegal market like opium, is now funding the Taliban, which is on the verge of inflicting a major military defeat of NATO. And at some point, we're going to see that the war on drugs and the war on terror, as currently practiced, are not compatible wars, and one of them needs to be reassessed as a policy if we're going to be successful with the other.
There's something that's happening in that region. Blackwater seems to be moving in and making deals with some of those governments.
You mean in the Central Asia, up to the north? I have to say, it is a competitive area. It's a competitive area of Russian interests and American interests. I would actually say that Russia is probably reasserting itself more effectively than the United States and American business and the administration is. But everyone is interested in that region, partly because of Afghanistan and the whole business of the Taliban and Pakistan, but also partly because of its proximity to the oil wealth of Kazakhstan above all else, and the gas wealth of Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan, which would explain the interest of somebody like Blackwater.
Is there a danger to the United States in entities such as Blackwater, which are essentially freebooters?
Well, what Blackwater represents is the huge privatization. I mean, interestingly enough, the criminal organizations and so on that I talk about are often what I refer to in sort of sociological jargonese as privatized law enforcement agencies, because mm-hmm. the state is unable to do the business, and so organized criminal groups do it instead. Now, in some respects, this is licensed and it's useful. In South Africa, for example, the white communities are largely policed nowadays by things like ADT and Chubb Security. They're basically private law enforcement agencies, and it's a useful thing because the white community tends to pay for the policing of their community, which means there's more money available in the state budget for the policing of society as a whole. So in South Africa, the acceptance of privatized law enforcement was a good thing. In other areas, it is clearly not a good thing, and frequently you'll find that the use of Blackwater in places like Iraq are an extremely onerous burden on the American budget. I think Joe Stiglitz goes into this very well in his book, The $3 trillion War. It's not something that I have looked at very closely, but I do see it as a mirroring in the licit world of practices in the illicit world, and that is the privatization of law enforcement, which essentially is a dangerous thing because it can run out of the control of states' purview without too much difficulty.
I want to thank the caller. I have somebody else I want to get to. We're already past our midpoint here in the conversation. And again, I'd just like to quickly introduce our guest, Misha Glenny. During the early 90s, he was the Central Europe correspondent for the BBC World Service and covered the war in the former Yugoslavia. He won a Sony Award for his reporting in 1993. He makes his home in London, but right at the moment, he's spending some time in the United States talking about his new book, recently published. The title is McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld. It's published by Knopf, and it's the result of several years of reporting on his part, traveling around the world, looking at the growth of organized crime in Central Europe, but also in Asia, in Latin America, even in North America. One of the things he says in the book that he was surprised to learn that organized crime was so big in Canada. That might surprise a lot of Americans, too. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just for a moment, and we'll get onto this caller in a moment, but to return to the subject of armaments, already we certainly know that for the shadow economy, one of their big products is guns. We also know that the trade in small arms around the world, things like rifles and pistols and rocket Rebel grenades, things like that, things that people can carry. That is a big business. But I guess I wonder to what extent the shadow economy is tied up with the, you know, the illicit arms business is tied up with the licit.
Well, essentially the difference between the illicit and the licit is the licit is carried out with the explicit say-so of states. That doesn't mean that the licit arms economy ensures that weapons don't get into the wrong hands, or sometimes states don't sell their weapons to people who they really ought not to be selling their weapons to. But that is the essential differentiation. I have spoken to people, I've interviewed at length for the book, for example, some people who were associates and collaborators with Victor Boot, the Russian arms dealer who we referred to before, who argued very forcefully that Victor Boot was doing nothing more than what most major state manufacturers and state licensed sellers of weapons do in any event, and so that the pursuit of Victor Boot was really an unfair thing. Now, I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. I would like to see states' licensing of arms tightened up rather than a loosening and allowing freelancers like Victor Boot to run all over the world. But there's no doubt about it that, you know, states were involved in some pretty shady, murky deals themselves, which, again, I mean, it comes back at the moment in Britain to this, the big issue of the BAE Systems scandal and Saudi Arabia.
Well, let's talk with some others. We'll go to Matt Toon for our next caller. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Oh, I was contemplating over your remark about Afghanistan, and what troubles me is the fact that Afghanistan has always been growing opium primarily because it's a great cash crop. And to come into a country like that and eradicate whatever the leaders were, you cannot eradicate, and I don't, America has not been successful eradicating the opium trade there. In fact, it's increased over the last, since the Americans have arrived. But more importantly, this is, this illegal drug trade is kind of inspiring for lots of money. And I'm sure Al-Qaeda and other people are sponsoring the Taliban dramatically to get them back in. Plus, the I don't really see that what America could have done very easily to transform this country back unless the opium thing could have been taken care of. And I have no idea what would have replaced opium for these people in Afghanistan. So I'd like to hear your comments about that.
Well, you're absolutely right about the increase. I don't think the sense of increase really does it justice. We're seeing year-on-year rises in opium production in Afghanistan, which are in the region of sort of 55 to 57%. It goes up every year. Huge amounts are coming onto the market. Large parts of the world are flooded with cheap heroin because of this, of what's going on in Afghanistan. And eradication isn't going to happen in Afghanistan, partly because there's so much resistance from the Europeans, including the British on this occasion, to using chemical eradication techniques, but partly because that has patently not worked in a country where there's been big government support for chemical eradication, which is Colombia and the cocaine industry. So what one has to do is to start rethinking and reassessing the policy. Now, there is a group called the Senless Council, which is made up of very venerable former politicians, former members of the Senate in Canada or the House of Lords in Britain, former French ministers, and indeed an ex-head of Interpol, who argue that we should use the opium grown in Afghanistan for medical purposes. This is not being accepted by governments around the world, including the American government. I think we should be having a debate about things like this, because at the moment, all we're doing, as you point out, is funding the Taliban and funding al-Qaeda.
Hmm. Well, do you go as far as to suggest that if we really decide that the international trade in illegal drugs is a problem, that one of the most direct ways we could attack that would be to do drug legalization?
I think what I try and argue in the book is as follows, is that the war of drugs is a complete and utter failure in every respect, and this needs to be reassessed. Whether one goes to a straight legalization or so, I wouldn't like to say now. What I would like to say is that we have to have a debate, an adult debate about this, looking at just how destructive the consequences of the war of drugs are, both on producer countries like Afghanistan and Colombia, and on consumer countries like the United States or Britain and Western Europe, and say, okay, this isn't working, what is going to work? And have everything out on the table, including legalization, and to be able to argue sensibly and in an adult fashion about legalization without being accused of being a baby killer when one so does. And that's really the issue. This is now so important because of the Afghan situation and the power it is giving to Taliban that we can no longer, afford to argue just from very sort of strongly moral positions about the damage that drugs do to our young people. Because at the moment, I mean, we've had the war on drugs really in one form or another since the early 20s. And drugs have never been more widely available, nor have they been more widely used than they are now, not just in our countries, but all over the world. This is reaching epidemic proportion. So obviously, our policies are broke, and we have to start thinking very seriously about how you go about fixing them. And the other thing is that, since the early 90s, the revenue and resources available to organized crime, including those involved in the backbone of organized crime, which is the narcotics industry, have risen astronomically. There has been no concomitant increase in the revenues available to law enforcement around the world. And so they cannot possibly be expected to dent the drugs market with what they have at the moment. They're simply chasing their tails. They're exhausted, and I have a lot of sympathy for people involved in that.
All right, let's talk with others. Here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, we can't stop the narcotics coming into our country, the seat of our power, with our domestic police and our soldiers. And how does President Bush think we can stop it halfway around the world at great expense to us?
I don't know. You better ask President Bush.
Rhetorical question, no doubt. The answer is, well, that you can't.
Well, let me ask you something else, too. If we were to legalize marijuana or decriminalize whatever, would that not have the same effect as the ending of prohibition? Because then that forced the hoodlums to either get legal or get out. There was no longer immense profits, no longer $15 a quart for a bottle of whiskey back in the 20s. Wouldn't that solve a lot of the problems, because it would eliminate the gangsterism element just as it did in the 20s?
If you talk to most economists, or most economists I spoke to, across the world, not just in the United States, and in Europe, but also in countries like Russia and South Africa, if you talk to them about the marijuana market, they see it very much in the same way as prohibition. The market is made illegal, and because it's an illegal market, then you get value added for those people who are bringing the product to the market. And if you have as huge a demand for marijuana as you do in the United States, Western Europe, and other countries across the world, and you have the production capacity to do it, then you're going to have people who are going to take the risk to bring it across borders and things like that. And this is what I discovered when I visited British Columbia in Canada, which is a major production area for marijuana. It's now worth about 5% of BC's GDP, and that's official government statistics we're talking about. In the Greater Vancouver area alone, I spoke to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They estimated that there are about 25,000 growing operations in residential houses. That's not including grow ops that are going on in industrial houses or indeed out in the open air in the bush. And the people who are exporting this, who generally don't actually come into contact with drugs themselves, are making vast sums of money, but huge sums of money. And they were quite frank about this, both in Canada and Colombia, they are huge supporters on the war on drugs because this is what makes them their money. It is the same, in my opinion, as prohibition, and maybe it's time for one to start for people to start looking at this in this way.
Yeah, although I want to thank the caller for his comments. I think though that you also have to keep in mind with the kind of diversification in the product line that organized crime has that. The drug legalization might put a big dent in their profits, but as long as you still have people around the world who are willing to buy smuggled cigarettes because they're cheaper or buy pirated DVDs, that organized crime, these people in the shadow economy, are still going to be able to find products to sell that people will want to buy. Some of those things that are actually legally available, that's just there's just cheaper that way.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The commodities and services provided by criminal syndicates and provided by the shadow economy can be divided into different sectors. There are those which exist in illegal markets, like narcotics. There are those which usually exist in very grey markets, like women who are trafficked into prostitution. And then there are those which exist in legal markets, like, as you point out, cigarettes, who have high tax regimes. And that's the smuggling of legally manufactured cigarettes is to do with the fact that some countries impose huge taxes on cigarettes in order to raise revenue, and criminals are exploiting that. So there are different ways that they make money, and what we need to do is actually identify how each commodity creates revenue for criminals and see what mechanisms are available to us to reduce that and to pull the financial rug from under their feet, as it were. Now, on the issue of counterfeit DVDs and counterfeit goods in general, we have a very, very serious long-term problem here, because what has happened under globalization is you've seen the shift of manufacturing jobs away from the West and into countries like China and other countries in East Asia. And that means that we are more dependent on generating revenue from our service and creative industries. And in that instance, for us, the concept of intellectual property rights, ownership of ideas and inventions, are very, very important. But for the Chinese and other manufacturing economies who need to produce and sell into markets all over the world, they're much less concerned about intellectual property rights issues. And what we're going to see as a consequence, you get Mattel toys with lead paint in them. You know, in some cases, for example, Volkswagen found VW found a batch of brake pads which were manufactured in their legal manufacturing train, their licensed manufacturing train in China. But these cheaper brake pads had been insinuated into the chain, and they were imported and sold on the German market before they were spotted. And over the next 10 to 15 years, the way that China and other emerging markets, selling markets in the East, interact with the European Union, Japan, and the United States over this very issue of how we interpret counterfeit goods, this is going to determine a lot about the future of the world.
Yeah, certainly here in the United States, not all that long ago, we saw a problem with a medication, a prescription medication, that apparently was made with raw materials that were produced in China, a thing called heparin, which is a blood thinner. And some people here in the United States actually died as a result of this contaminated product. There apparently is some question exactly what happened, but that it happened on the Chinese end, and that you have to, that and other kinds of contaminated issues of consumer products, you have to ask, well, is this in fact just another manifestation of this, that somebody there has found a way to make a buck by selling a product that's adulterated and that gets into the distribution system. And then we start to see problems that it ends up in products that are imported to the United States and to Europe. I believe the same drug has caused problems in Germany and elsewhere in the United States. And it all goes back to the fact that it's made from a raw material that comes out of pig intestines, I believe, in China.
Ooh, yucky.
Yeah. Well, let's talk again with another caller here. Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Hello. I'd just like to point out that in the case of the opium production in Afghanistan, the Taliban had actually stamped out most of the opium production prior to our invasion. But then we brought back the Northern Alliance, who were notoriously corrupt, and I think the results were predictable.
It's certainly true that the Taliban did stamp out production. At the time, they were they were trying to ingratiate themselves somewhat with the United Nations. But not only that, you know, the Taliban have maintained they had an ideological objection to production. But it was a totalitarian state, effectively, and the Taliban, you know, asserted its authority through brutal policing mechanisms. Now, we can do something about the narcotics industry if we hand over all our civil rights to a totalitarian policing system. As you point out, the Northern Alliance was heavily involved in the opium industry. There are still many people involved in the legitimate Afghanistan administration who are involved in the opium industry. In the south of the country, it just determines absolutely everything. There's a really wonderful book, which I recommend to you, along, of course, with my own book, called The Desert of Death, by a soldier called Leo Doherty, an officer in the British Army who's since left the British Army, in which he explains very graphically about how the entire economy of southern Afghanistan is dictated by the poppy, as he refers to it. You know, I mean, we've got to start making very difficult choices about this issue.
Our guest in this hour, Misha Glenny. His book is McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld, published by Knopf. We have about 5 minutes left. We have someone next to talk with in Geneva. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, yeah, I'm looking forward to reading that book. I got to say that we're in a world of hurt in this country. I think because we have too many freedoms, we're allowing too many people to come in here and basically take things for granted. And when it comes to, like, drugs, I know of people, they get promised stuff because some company or some doctor or pharmaceutical company outside of this country says, oh, sir, come over here. You know, we've got a miracle drug for cancer, or we got a miracle drug for Alzheimer's. You know, and they go over there and they find out, you know, things are happening. It's not all what it's cracked up to be. The problem I see with this whole world is the world economy. We're bringing ourselves down to somebody else's level. And, you know, I can't help but cringe every time I see, you know, we're one of the world's worst polluters, which I think I very doubt that, especially if I know people who live in China could tell me otherwise. Just that China, it's just that one country alone out pollutes everybody else. But the point I'm trying to bring up is that we're getting turned around in this whole world with this country and trying to make people happy, other people besides our own. And I would like to know when it's time for us to stop doing that, become an isolationist country again, and take care of people here before we start doing things.
Well, I think you'd find, I mean, the problem for the United States economy is that it would be very difficult for the U.S. to become an isolationist economy because a lot of its money is made abroad by exploiting markets elsewhere. And there's give and take on this sort of thing. I mean, one of the interesting things about illegal migration, for example, is that on the whole, those illegal migrants into the U.S. And into Western Europe, on the whole, they do not come here to claim Social Security benefits and social services. On the whole, they come here because businesses which want to employ these people, and they want to employ them for as little money as possible. And so, you know, these are American-owned businesses which are complicit in the trade of bringing illegal migrants over into the United States. And we see that big time in Europe as well. So we've got, you know, you've got a globalized economy now where you would find it very, very difficult for the U.S. to sustain its general standard of living if it were to cut out of trade with other people, because it's very, very dependent on material that it sells into those markets outside. So it's a kind of give-and-take situation, I would assess.
I think something that you have to say here is that the things that drive the shadow economy, these illegal enterprises, essentially the same things that drive the legal economy. That is, in parts of the world, we have developing economies and people who want to increase their standard of living. They're interested in making money and prospering. And that in the developed world, there are people who have money. They have a certain standard of living which they want to maintain. So they have money to spend. And on both ends of that relationship, there are people who want things and are willing to supply them and pay for them. And so it seems as if, in fact, disentangling the legal and the illegal economies of the world it's not that easy.
It is. It's very difficult. You're absolutely right. But let me give an example of what happens when you do have sort of semi-isolationist policies. We have regimes both in Europe and in the United States which subsidize our farmers, often very, very heavily. Now, when communism fell in Eastern Europe, one of the countries it fell in was Albania, which was the poorest country in Europe. One of the few things that Albania was able to sell to the European Union were oranges and lemons. But because we subsidize our orange and lemon growers in Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Greece to the extent we do, it rendered the citrus fruits of Albania unprofitable. They simply couldn't compete with the subsidies given to European Union farmers. And so what they did was the peasants destroyed all of their citrus groves and they planted marijuana there instead. And they found they had a very vibrant and willing market in the European Union to purchase their marijuana. But it's just a shame they got rid of those citrus groves, because we have this ludicrous tariff system called the Common Agricultural Policy, which is mirrored in the U.S. by the U.S. farm subsidies regime.
Well, I think that we're about at the point where we're going to have to stop, and I just wanted people to know that it is a very rich and complex story and really a fascinating book, a remarkable piece of reporting on your part. You have any idea how many miles you put on?
I feel rather guilty about that, clocking up all those air miles to do it. But I did go around the world. But if you really want to get underneath it, I mean, I felt I had to go and interview the gangsters, interview the police, and so on. It was the only way, I'm afraid, I can do it. But it was a fair few miles, I admit.
Well, the book is McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld. The book is published by Knopf, by our guest, Misha Glenny. He's former BBC correspondent, now makes his home in London, spending some time in the United States talking about the book. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Look, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate it.